Good morning and welcome to the Mesa City Council study session for April the 28th. We'd like to excuse Council Members Luna and Thompson, who are out of, Richens and Luna, who are out of town, and Council Member Luna, who is still recovering but doing well. I spoke with him yesterday, and I think he's on the path to returning to us shortly. The first item on our agenda is to review the agenda for the May 2nd Council meeting. So, Council, if you can please take a look at that. Item three are the various liquor license applications. Four, various purchasing contracts. Mr. Hirschberg, do you have an item on the agenda that we need to talk about?
Mayor, Council, just wanted to let you know on item 4G, the sludge grinders, we've been working with purchasing. We also use that equipment in the park system. On our lakes to filter out large particle matter and sludge before it enters into the lake system and clogs the filters and irrigation system. So when you see the agenda on Monday, there'll actually be a price increase of another $40,000 on that item for a total of $170,000.
Okay. Everybody got that? Yes, Mr. Cavanaugh.
I have a question on 4H, the roll-off containers.
Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor.
Thank you. And I guess my question is just to verify how many current containers do you currently utilize, and what would this purchase, where would it bring your inventory to?
I don't have the exact inventory numbers. I'm sorry, I didn't bring those with me today. But I can tell you that we consistently have demand that's exceeding the level of service that we're able to provide. Just to give you an idea, our fiscal year-to-date revenue for the roll-off program is up $369,000 this year. And we had a similar increase last year where we came in about the same over budget. And so what we've done, we've actually held back one roll-off truck to try and help keep up with the level of service. But what we're running into issues with right now is we don't have the roll-offs, especially the 30 and the 40 yards, which are the larger containers, to service all of the customers that would like to have our service.
Great. And I think this is an excellent proposal to bring forward, because I think everyone on the council will agree with me that this is a very, very popular program, and that we get a lot of inquiries and requests for it, because it goes a long, long way to spruce up the city, clean up neighborhoods, encourage people to rehab their yards and their homes and things like that. So I'm glad you bring it forward, and I'm hoping that this will help you meet the demand.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on agenda item four? Five is extinguishing a public easement. Six are various resolutions. Seven is introducing some zoning ordinances. Eight, yes, Mr. Finter.
On 7A, it talks about increasing the width of the sidewalks. I remember getting some feedback recently, some concerns of impacts on already established developments. How does that work now? Are we doing that citywide, or was that for just a particular?
Yeah, the change will be prospective is the concept. And so really what this change is to bring the desert upland standard similar to the other city standards. We actually have two charts within the code. They were different. We recognize that. This is really sort of a cleanup to make sure that they match each other.
Okay.
Just one quick additional answer. No, we are not requiring existing developments to go back in and extend the sidewalk. This actually came up a few months ago with one particular developer that you're familiar with, where their previous development had been a 4-foot sidewalk, and then we asked for the current requirement. So the new development has to comply, but at this point in time, there's not a requirement that existing development has to be retrofitted.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Zelenko. Any other questions, Council, related to item seven? Eight are some, again, zoning ordinances.
Mayor.
Yes.
Just wanted to point out on item 8B, which is a development agreement that goes with item 8A, we're still fine-tuning the last pieces of that development agreement. So you haven't seen it yet. We'll be getting that finished up today and out to the council, so you'll have it review prior to Monday.
But John, if the development agreement is not completed today, then we'll be pulling this item, correct?
That's what we
are continuing.
That's what we need
continuing
to do
the item. So we need the developer to work with us to get these issues resolved. If not, we will be continuing this item.
Okay. I assume they know that. Agenda item 9, taking public comment on other planning and zoning ordinances. So it looks like right now we have everything on the consent agenda. We'll see if it stays that way. Okay, any other questions related to the agenda, Council? If not, next item for us in this meeting is to hear a presentation and discuss the City Council's strategic priority, public safety, as it relates to the police department and its proposed budget. Gentlemen, I see a lot of our assistant chiefs and administrators here. Gentlemen, thank you. Welcome. I'm sorry this was scheduled to happen a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sorry that didn't. But so thank you for coming back. We're looking forward to your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor, council members, and we appreciate the extra time. We were able to add another 15 slides to our presentation in the next 2 weeks.
So,
okay.
So you'll be taking about half the time of fire, is what you're saying. Okay. All right. Thank you.
First of all, good morning, and thank you for allowing us to present with you today. Chief Mesa, unfortunately, was unable to be here today. He had a pre-scheduled event out of state, so our staff is going to work together to pinch hit on his behalf related to the budget. I'd like to introduce everybody here today. My name is Mike Dvorak. I'm the Assistant Chief over the Investigations Bureau. With us as a co-presenter today as well is Krissa York. She's our Fiscal Administrator. And to my far right is Tony Filler. He is the Assistant Chief over our Operations Bureau. And then to my left is Tony Lithgow. He's our Assistant Chief over Administrative Services. And to my far left is Assistant Chief Mike Solberg over our Community Engagement and Employee Wellness. So we're pleased to be here with you today to talk about our presentation. We'll start first with the first slide, which is talking about our safest, largest cities. And kind of the highlights to this slide was really what I'm going to highlight is what we have done related to crime during this past year. And I'm going to start off with how proud we are of the men and women that work here at the police department. When you look at the numbers we're going to talk about, this really is representative of the officers, the professional staff, and the civilian members of our agency that work collectively together to really make this happen. So without the great people we have, this would be impossible to do. So starting with, I wanted to mention is, I think a highlight is the Major City Chiefs Association came out with talking about the safest cities in the United States of major cities. And Mesa was one of three cities nationwide that did not report an increase in violent crime from 2014 to 2015, which is quite an accomplishment when you think of the cities across the nation. The other two cities that did not show an increase in violent crime were Detroit and El Paso, which gives perspective to a lot of what's going on throughout the nation. So quite an accomplishment, I think, from our agency, 38th largest city in the country, to really show that kind of decrease. The bottom of the slide talks a little about our 2015 statistics, and I think it's highlighted by our decrease in both violent and property crimes during 2015. Overall, in a Part 1 crimes, we had an 8% reduction from 2014, which is phenomenal results. Next slide kind of provides a graph on depicting what I just talked about in the Part 1 crimes. And for those listening at home and for those who may not know, to give you a quick idea of the Part 1 crimes, it includes major crimes such as homicide, sexual assault, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, stolen vehicles, and major theft. So the major crimes that certainly can impact the community. With that, we showed our first increase in 2014 of a 2% increase in overall Part 1 crimes. And as mentioned, our 2015 original goal coming into the year was a 5% decrease, and how do we try to impact that number? And we were successful to get to that 8% decrease in overall Part 1 crimes that I mentioned. To put it in kind of more of a human perspective, that's about 1,162 people in our community that were not a victim of a major Part 1 crime in 2015. Which is certainly, I think, makes it more personal to understand what that means and the trauma that goes along with that. So we're very proud of those results, but still have a lot of work still to do in that regard. Next slide is talk a little about our Part 1 arrests in 2015. And I think when you look at this graph, it demonstrates what you want to see. As we look at it from our executive staff, we want to see a few things. Number one is we see a decrease in Part 1 crimes, which is certainly a good thing, but also the increase of arrests, which means that we're lowering crime at the time of making arrests that are impacting really three areas. It shows that we're really demonstrating a good application of our intelligence-led policing, that our arrests are not just arrests, they're arrests that are impacting crime overall, certainly in our Part 1 crimes, and that we're arresting the people committing most of the crimes. And then it allows us in our intelligence-led, as we work very hard on directing our resources to the time and locations where those crimes are happening. So this is a good picture that you would want to see when we look at it from a CompStat perspective. I think one of the highlights of the arrest area is the work of the men and women who are on the street working, where our drug arrests were up 10.6% from 2014. That's an important number because that outreach goes to so many other major crimes. And I think shows about the field contacts that are done, reference issues, and with the hope that when you make those arrests, we're also looking for hopefully intervention for those that have problems so that they're getting help so we're not having repeat offenders when they come out. Next slide is a quick depiction of our citations, but I kind of put it under the caveat of our, if you think about our three E's of our traffic safety program, we focus on education, enforcement, and engineering. In 2015, when it comes to the enforcement part, we saw a 7% increase in citations from 2014. Again, it's a small part of the overall traffic safety program, but I think noteworthy in terms of the efforts in that area. And it's really our first increase in the last 4 years. But I think additional information that highlights this is our warnings are up 43%. And what that means is the education piece that goes along with the enforcement. And not only are we making a lot of stops, it's not just for citations. Our goal is to educate and to learn so that those violations don't continue to occur. So the increase in warnings is good to see because we're not only citing those hazardous violations, we're also increasing our warnings to educate our public on safe driving practices. So I think that was certainly noteworthy. I think a sidebar I'd like to mention, too, is a little bit on our accidents. Certainly accidents is one of our challenges that we look at each year. We did have a non-injury accident increase of 11%, an injury accident increase of 4%. With that, the fatal accidents were even, and that's certainly one of our major drives. We had 19, which is 19 too many. So when we talk about our overall traffic safety program, we certainly keep those numbers in mind of how to reduce those kinds of fatalities and injuries as well. So we'll move on to the next slide. It talks a little bit about our highlights and accomplishments. And I'll quickly go through each of the areas to give you an idea of really this is how do we accomplish our task of reducing crime and impacting our community in a positive way so that we feel safe in everything that we do. And we'll talk a little on intelligence-led policing, which I mentioned earlier. This is really where we work smarter. With limited resources and certainly a lot of needs, where do we put our resources? So we use intelligence-led policing to do real-time analysis of our crime, to strategically deploy our resources so that they're used in the best way possible. Our CompStat model, as you well know, is really something we have done for quite some time. We're one of our innovators in that in the state of Arizona. We still apply it on a regular basis in terms of daily. We do it at the squad and shift level where we're looking at real-time information related to our crimes. Weekly, they have divisional meetings to look at the picture within each district of what's going on to make sure they understand what's happening and strategies are developed to combat whatever they're seeing. And then monthly, Chief Filler does his CompStat of all patrol talking about at apartment level and making sure that similar practices are learned throughout the city. So the CompStat model is certainly a key component of our accomplishments. Decentralized investigations at each of the four patrol districts. Each district has a street crimes unit as well as detectives assigned. And what that allows is for the commander to have accountability and ownership for the crime that occurs in his district. And he has resources that he can then apply to investigate them as well and address the problems quickly. And I think it adds to the responsiveness to the community in that area as well. The crime prevention focus, I'll just highlight a few areas, and I think you know a lot of the endeavors that we work on, but you know, our gay night that we held last October, over 82 parties that we attended. I couldn't get to all of them, but I did eat at about 7 of them. But one of our best nights, we're really seeing the community come out and meet city officials, the fire and medical department, all parts of the city departments are out, including the police department. Our TriStar properties, where we work with the properties to really improve some of the crime prevention elements at their properties, is a big part. We have 142 citywide that we work with that have been certified under TriStar, which really helps us decrease calls for service and make them safer places to live. And then we have just shy of 400 neighborhood watch programs throughout the city, 396. So that's quite a number. It really shows our community engagement, which, as we know, is really the core element that is important for us to do our role in keeping our community safe, is having that interaction and the ability for comfort levels so that we get information and we're exchanging information on what's going on in their neighborhood. The last item is, I think, one of the most important investments we have ever made in the city of Mesa, and that's our forensic lab. There is no agency in the entire country, and I have the privilege of going to being part of Major City Chiefs and being some of the subcommittees that go on throughout the country, and there is no agency that has the responsiveness that we have in terms of our forensic lab. We have graduated to the point of having no backlog in our DNA analysis, which is phenomenal. And we are the only agency I'm aware of on a regular basis that uses DNA to resolve property crimes. And if you think about that, instead of waiting for 15 pattern crimes of a burglary to occur, we may have DNA collection on the first one or the second one and be able to perhaps impact an arrest before 13 more people may be impacted with a burglary. So our forensic lab, that's just a small highlight of the tremendous work they do, which is all part of our crime fighting model. One additional item I want to focus on is, you know, when Chief Mesa put one of his major initiatives, he established a fourth bureau this year, last year when he took over back in February. And it was a community engagement and employee wellness bureau that was led by Assistant Chief Mike Solberg. And to me, it's highlighted because I talk a lot about some of the community engagement efforts that have increased just in the past year, as well as our focus on our employees. And if you think about it in this way, in order for our employees to go out and help our community, our employees have to be taken care of as well. So they're in the best frame of mind, they're in the best physical position to hopefully provide the best service to our community. So that is critical in order to provide the service levels that we aspire to. So we have 11 community forums. Chief Mesa just met with all of them last month, jointly talking about the state of the department and having great interaction. One of the things we're proud of for, I know myself being here a long time here in Mesa, was how important our Explorer program was throughout the years. And we were very proud to bring that back. And it is now working outstanding, has great leadership, and have over 20 of our youth in our Explorer program, and it continues to grow. So we're very proud of that. This year we partnered with the Mesa Fire and Medical Department and our police department, and Commander Burlingame, who's sitting behind me, was a lead for the police department, as well as Assistant Chief Cantrell prior to her departure, of putting on our first Aspire Academy. And that was 28 young girls that in the teenage area coming in and getting exposed in 3 days. Instead of going to spring break and having a break somewhere else, they came to the Aspire program and got a chance to get exposed to both professions, public safety and as first responders, and was just a resounding success. It was amazing to see the interaction there. We've also started our mental health advisory board, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And we've done some of our employee initiatives have been we've done a resiliency training, which is all officers are going through to help with their own personal wellness, as well as our Code 9 training, which Mesa has been a leader in the state on, to talk about the issues of PTSD and ensuring that help is and support is given by organizations. So I think a lot of successes, those are just a few highlights in the community engagement as well as our employee wellness area. The last item I'll talk about in terms of accomplishments was really an illustration of our evaluation and our adaptation that we have to require for emerging issues throughout a year. The two that are highlighted there is obviously with light rail corridor, with the light rail expansion coming to fruition this year. We've made adjustments to bring three officers to on bike patrol in that area to provide a presence, both in terms of education as well as enforcement and presence, really. So as we get accustomed to the increased traffic that light rail brings.
Excuse me, Chief. Mr. Kavanaugh has a question for you.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate you mentioning this among the highlights. And colleagues, one of the budget issues I'm hoping that we are going to look at is one of the unfunded projects, which was for additional bike patrol officers at a figure of about $799,000, as I recall. And I certainly intend to support adding that into the budget. And it was brought home even more particularly so yesterday, watching the presentation that we had from the students from Arizona State University, looking at downtown, looking at the needs for downtown, because with the initiative to have ASU have a campus in downtown, the expansion of enrollment at Wilkes and Benedictine, the housing projects that we've approved, the ones that we're encouraging, I think over the next 12 to 36 months, we're going to see an increasing what I call densification of people and activity along the light rail corridor. And the feedback that I've heard from the operations of the bike patrol has been nothing but positive. And I'm hearing that both as a council member and as a board member for Valley Metro Rail. It is a program that is innovative, successful, adaptive, and nimble. And it makes a presence that the bad guys know. And so I think I'm glad that they brought it to our attention. They should be proud of that, but we also should take account of the other decisions that we're making that is going to increase the need for it. So, again, that's where I'm coming from, and I'm hoping that others will agree. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Vice Mayor. Appreciate that. I know Chief Filler, we're going to talk on that topic a little bit later here in the presentation, but he was one of our probably most active bike officers back in the day, and those that have worked bikes always know how important the community interaction is on bikes, how approachable you are. And I think that plays a good role. So I appreciate the comments, and we'll talk further here shortly. The second area that we had our adaptation for an issue this year was on the human exploitation and trafficking. We have redeployed two detectives in my investigation bureau, and that was really an emerging issue that we're seeing nationally. That we also have local implications, and that is detectives that are specifically working the exploitation and trafficking of both juveniles and adults in that area. And we'll talk a little bit more on that as one of our objectives later on as well. The next slide gets in just an overview of our current staffing and talks a little bit on staffing going forward. Currently, we have 1,184 budgeted positions broken out through sworn and civilian, 760 sworn and 424 civilian and professional staff. And we highlight that the chart you see below really talks a little bit about the International Association of Chiefs of Police have a recommendation where patrols should be working and evenly distributed in those three areas. And the three areas that are talked about are answering calls for service, proactive work where you're out looking for activity or making contacts with the public, and then administrative time, obviously when you're doing a lot of your paperwork and other issues. So their recommendation is roughly a one-third for those three particular areas. So looking at that standard and kind of doing an application to our current time, the stats that you saw on that chart below, I should say, kind of tell you what our current percentages are. If you go back just one slide, I'm sorry. Our calls for service are about 43% in calls for service and 29% in proactive patrol and 28% in administrative. So keeping those in mind, the next slide talks a little bit about, as we did a projection of what that would mean if we were trying to aspire to get to looking at our staffing needs going forward, how would we get to that percentage and what would it mean? And so we did an analysis of the projected staffing needs for the next 5 years specific to that one-third, one-third, one-third ratio that I mentioned. And we used also a projection of population growth reported by MAG to kind of go out for those 5 years to give us some semblance of correlation to population. And with that, as you can see, to get to that in 2016, it would mean 93 additional officers to get to that ratio and be consistent with the IACP recommendations that I discussed. Now, I caution you that the 93 is just gives you an idea of what patrol would mean. It does not really include supervisors sworn in non-patrol assignments or civilian and professional staff that would need to support the 93. And something I also factor in from doing this is the impacts it then has along the lines with prosecution and courts. Obviously, with the officers, as you increase, it has effect throughout the system and criminal justice. I show that as a kind of a highlight in terms of a comparison of where staffing needs are headed and how it works with the IACP guidelines. But we do look forward to coming to you in the near future with a more comprehensive analysis of future staffing needs where we can talk further on this particular issue. This was just kind of to whet your appetite a little bit on kind of where we sit with the standards and where we may be heading in that regard. So,
excuse me, Chief.
Yes.
When do you plan on, when would you like to make that presentation on the staffing issue? When you say coming forward shortly, is it in the, are we talking about months from now, weeks from now?
We'll be prepared really whenever that's the availability is to come do it. We're currently working on what our projection would be, and then we look forward to talking really more comprehensively about what our staffing would need going forward so you have a better picture of what we forecast and perhaps the strategies necessary to get there or have some good conversation on where that's at.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. But at the same time, you have already, we're going to see at the last slide, Mayor, you've identified some specific programs you know today that are related to unmet needs that you want to bring up. So we will talk about some of that today, Mayor. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it looks like this is a pretty dramatic number right here. To get to this one-third, one-third, one-third number for 2016, which I think is this year, we need 93 additional officers plus supervisors plus non-sworn personnel to support that. That's a pretty good reveal right now, and yes. Certainly I'd love to hear more detail later on. But we're kind of spoiler alert: we need 93 new officers, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll come forward with more, like I said, more analysis of that. Today we're talking more on some programs that we're recommending that would be helpful today, as well, and that'll be a few slides down where we can talk about some of the other requests that we're looking for that we think will be impactful from a program standpoint. So the next few slides I'll turn over to Krissa York, who'll talk a little bit more specific on our budget and some of the finances involved.
Good morning. For fiscal year 16-17, our proposed total budget is approximately $181 million. What that is made up of is various funds listed below, of which the most significant is the general fund. It makes up 86% of our budget, followed by the quality of life fund at 9%. Included in this proposed budget is the $3 million for the one-third of the police department's radio replacements, which were previously acquired approximately 2002 to 2004 timeframe, as well as a crisis response team, which we will be addressing as well in a future slide. Considerable efforts have been made over the last years to reduce our overtime. Within the department, we have seen a pretty significant reduction in the number of sworn overtime hours. Contributing to this has been the positive effects we've had with the sworn overhires have helped in this effort. However, this has not come without a cost. We have training. Because of the current staffing issues, we're not able to provide the training and let our staff go to the training that they're needed, as well as additional time off, just trying to meet our critical staffing needs. Also, what you will see, there's not a comparable reduction in cost, and this is primarily due to the reduction or the increase we're seeing over the years in the public safety pension retirement rate. The following slide is kind of a visual depiction as what
I'm sorry. I think that's an important point. I mean, we're all familiar with the PSPRS poll that we've got as a between police and fire. So reducing overtime would reduce the numbers in that category, but you're saying we need to move money from that category over to the PSPRS category to help retire that unfunded. I'm not.
Chris, so I think what you're, we'll make sure, I think Mayor, so in their efforts, police department to being sensitive to their budget, they've taken on great strides to try to manage their overtime.
Yeah.
And that obviously, and I think they're describing, there have been some, as a result, that's put some strain on the training opportunities and things like that. But even in an effort, as they've worked so hard to manage overtime and keep that in within the budget, it then kind of gets overtaken. Those cost savings have been overtaken by the pension costs. Am I saying that, Chris?
That's, that we're looking 100% at? Correct.
So it's difficult because both of the public safety departments have worked very hard over the last, you know, several years, 5 to 6 years, to try to manage their cost. And specifically, we've kind of targeted overtime as a way to, an effort to do that. But then at the same time, the additional costs that have hit us from the public safety retirement system have significantly overtaken those reductions. So on the challenge is on paper, when we show the total budget, you don't see any effective reductions because of those pension costs. Yet underneath that, in the department level, they are making great sacrifices to try to manage their budget. So I think that's the challenge we have sometimes on paper. Those costs continue to go up despite the fact that there's a tremendous amount of effort to manage cost.
Right. I get it, but one's not necessarily related to the other.
No, yeah. but on the bottom line, it shows up.
Great. I get it. Thank you.
To put it in perspective, our public safety pension cost has increased 36% since fiscal year 13-14. And so with a stable budget, we're having to meet those needs. As Mr. Brady said, we're managing internally within that, but it is at a cost to our employees for not allowing time off and additional training that really is needed.
Okay. The next phase of the presentation, and talk a little bit about some of the programs that we just mentioned earlier in more detail. One of the programs that is currently slated to be in next year's budget is the crisis response team. And to give background for some, Chief Mazza, upon his arrival, really focused on how to improve our layers of assistance when dealing with those that are suffering from mental illness. And our police response and first responder actions that we can do to help. Our CIT program, which has been in place for quite some time, is certainly one of our foundational first responder mechanisms that we use as officers trained in how to interact and help situations. The second more advanced layer is what we're talking about today, is what he wanted to bring was a crisis response team. He announced it later in late 2015. And we are hoping to get it in this year's budget. And basically, it's to enhance our response to those suffering from mental illness. It's resources involved include a sergeant, a crisis intervention team coordinator who works with all of our outreach social services and the mental health system to provide resources, and then detectives assigned as well. The outcomes that we're looking for related to this team are specialized training for trained officers handling this particular function. So they have negotiator level training on talking to and working with those who are suffering from mental illness and other issues. We are looking that this intervention and this ability to have this team will reduce our calls for service to patrol. We'll then also allow this group to increase our training to the patrol officers. So they'll also be at briefings and in subsequent training is provide better depth of training to all our officers that are first responders. And we think it will increase the quality of care to our seriously mental ill in our community. Another outcome we expect to happen that we will track is also a decrease in use of force incidents. And that idea is that we are perhaps intervening prior to a crisis. And that allows us to hopefully seek intervention and seek social services and other aid before it becomes a crisis, where it becomes a police matter, where it's a much more difficult situation to resolve. Next slide gives you some statistics related to the scope of what, as first responders, that we officers deal with as they respond to various calls. And as you can see, is we had a 5.4% increase, but we have about 2,600 suicide calls that we respond to in a year. We also track those suffering from mental illness, the calls related to that, or another 1,100. And then we serve mental health detainers, and these are court orders that are sent from to the police department, basically directing us to bring someone in for assistance. And we served 637 of those last year. So we have over 4,419 calls during our year that deal in these particular areas. So this is what we're looking to impact. So our program goals is where this unit is able to serve those mental health detainers instead of patrol officers. That frees the patrol officers up for other duties. It allows more highly trained individuals to serve the mental health detainers, which we expect to be very successful. Our goal is to serve 80% of those going forward as part of our metrics that we're looking at. And we also are looking for a decrease of 75% of repeat calls for service by the ability to intervene quickly with the mental health detainer services, as well as aligning social services as well. So that is a crisis response team that is high on Chief Mays's priority list, and we're hopeful for it to be in the budget as well.
Yes. Chief, can you also maybe elaborate? I think when the chief and his staff presented this to us, there was a lot of proposals they had that we thought were important. This seemed to kind of rise to the top. So not only in the savings of a patrol officer's time, but we also talked a little bit, I don't know if you can cover it, that the idea too that having a trained professionals in this specific area, there were some experiences I think you cited from some other cities about the reduction in use of force as a result of some of this activity. Am I getting that correct?
That is correct.
Because then I thought that was, not only is it matching up our resources better and letting patrol officers who are spending a lot of time responding to these calls, keep them out on the streets doing the patrol, but also I think some experiences we saw that when you have a someone trained in this area, that also may result in fewer use of force. Am I correct in that? Could you share some of that with us?
Sure, please? I'd be happy to. Thank you. To give some background, we did some research with other agencies and the techniques and the different programs they had used before we moved forward with this recommendation and venture. And we looked particularly at Seattle and Tucson. And to give you some idea of that, we actually will have a hybrid of those two programs. But a lot of the main concepts come from a Tucson model, and their results have been very impressive to see. And that's where we've guided a lot of our anticipated outcomes with that. They have seen the following results in Tucson and Pima County, where this has been put into place. 85% of the mental health detainers were served, which was an increase from 40% prior to that when they had a unit specified to go out and serve these. So they are successful in getting them assistance. They saw an 18% reduction in welfare checks, and those are where the officers go out and check on someone's well-being. So those calls were reduced by that amount. And there are 400 transports for the mental health detainers where they took the individual in to get assistance. There were zero use of force incidents because of the members doing it were advanced trained in how to encounter that. And they were able to strategically pick the time and the place where that was done, which limits the likelihood of a confrontation. And there also is a reduction in multiple calls for service on the same person as well. And they had less incarceration time was what they're looking for. So a lot of improved interaction is what they saw, and we're hoping of having similar outcomes from what they've seen in Tucson.
That's great. The only it seems like with this, with 4,419 mental health related calls, the addition of one team with a sergeant and a few four detectives. I mean, it seems like the garden variety calls that a patrol officer deals with. I did a ride-along a few weeks ago and encountered several, in my opinion, severely mentally challenged people. It seems like that's having one team is, how are they going to be able to be a part of most of the police calls that are going on? Or it seemed to be somehow mental health related.
Right. And Mayor, members of council, I think the answer to that is in so much that that one team's going to be on as a first responder to each of those calls. It's really ability to force multiply in terms of the training that they'll provide to the officers who are the first responders on the ones that they're not going to be there. But what they're really doing is working behind the scenes to prevent those calls from happening in the first place. And that's through serving of the mental health detainers. That's through intervention before there's a crisis with members of our community that are generating a lot of calls for service, but also really is the call for help. And if they are proactively investigating and looking of how ways to connect them to social services, we anticipate those calls then will not happen as mentioned in those statistics.
Chief, there was, I hope I'm saying this correct, there was a number of your officers that are trained in this area, and I forget what that number was. So it's not as if we don't have individuals out in the field today. What do you know what the number is off the top of your head?
I believe at the top of my head, I think it was we have about 22% of our workforce of first responders that are trained in crisis intervention specific. And then our goal this year is to get to 25%. The national recommendation is somewhere between 20 and 25%. So this team will also allow us, the prominent trainers that will be part of those programs to slowly creep us even higher as our future years go on. So we think that training is going to give our first responders collectively more in-depth ability to handle those situations. And at the same time, the hope that this team also then, based on what we see in the statistics, should reduce those calls for service of those incidents that could occur in the first place. Okay. Next slide. The next slide is talking a little bit about some of the future needs and programs that we discussed earlier. And certainly when we've looked at our current needs, we identified several areas that we think are very critical for us now. One of the suggestions is the community action officers at each of our divisions. And this proposal is to, at this point, is bring back having two community action officers assigned to each one of our patrol divisions. With that allows them to really focus on several key areas. They are then not just the link to the community in terms of relationships, but they're able to look for the deeper root problems and resolve them that generate calls for service. So they can then address some of the areas that we have our most repeat calls for service, find some of the root causes behind them, and find the services, whether it's other city services or working with the owners to fix things or to find solutions to problems that really generate calls for service. But there also are outreach throughout that division that can give responsiveness to problems that come up from community leaders, from obviously council, from police department, all sources of information that come in and allows us to address them quickly and dedicate them to the community. So we would like to, in our program, they have two assigned to each of the districts, which is a total of 8 officers in this particular program. The next item is what was mentioned earlier, the light rail corridor bicycle patrol. This program is, desire is to have 5 officers and a sergeant to be involved with the light rail downtown. We feel it would give us a much better presence to handle a lot of the issues that occur, but also I think with all our bringing in all the patrons that are coming into our city through light rail, the presence of officers downtown provide information. They provide a feeling of security, but also it also provides great interaction in addition to the enforcement efforts that you would take in that area. We, in order to really cover a lot of the events that we have downtown and the light rail traffic, our recommendation was to have 5 officers and a sergeant added specific to the bike patrol in the light rail corridor area. The third item is, I mentioned earlier about the human exploitation and trafficking, which we call the HEAT team. We temporarily moved over 2 detectives to work this particular issue that we feel is an emerging issue that requires our dedicated attention. We are asking for 4 officers, a crime analyst as part of this venture to give us the best presence. So this is an area that we have been involved with but have been supported primarily by Nancy Baldwin, and the Hickey Foundation has been kind enough to give us grants that have allowed us to run operations throughout the year funded through the Hickey Foundation so that we can pay officers separate from their duties to also investigate these crimes. In response to what we have seen through those particular operations is why I moved two detectives specifically and full-time to this particular responsibility. To do it well, we need four detectives and a sergeant. I think the link as well is being a large East Valley agency and really the lead in the East Valley. We have regional outreach, and it allows us to really, I think, exponentially increase our reach throughout the East Valley and connect with the other cities as well, and we will be a regional leader in this particular area. This is certainly the drive behind the HEAT program is to intervene between juveniles that are being trafficked in sex trafficking and rescue them from the situation that they're in, and as well as adults, and find ways to get them help and assistance and rescue them from the situation, as well as put those responsible for that activity in jail that are making that happen. So it is a problem throughout the state, throughout the nation, and we certainly see it here in Mesa as well. So that is also another program need that we have brought forward. Last items we have talked about is our life cycle items, and we have many needs in that area. We've highlighted a need for, we are working currently on a CAD and RMS replacement plan that will be done through either bond or through life cycle. That is certainly a need coming up in our future to make sure that we stay ahead of the technology for our systems. And we have other life cycle needs, console replacements for dispatch that are quite expensive, and a whole list of life cycle items that certainly we hope to have budget assistance with as time goes on as well. So those are just a quick highlight of those future needs in terms of some programs that we feel we need today, I should say, and then our other future needs, like in the staffing, like I said, we'll talk about it at a later time more in depth.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Glover.
Just to echo some of the words that Vice Mayor Kavanaugh said earlier about the light rail corridor bike patrol, like it was mentioned by you of how effective it is, I think everybody recognizes it. Even in my conversations with Mr. Brady, it was one of those top items. I really think that we should move it into the budget now and be proactive rather than reactive 3 years down the road. And this way, everybody gets a peace of mind. When I've talked to business owners and then those that frequent downtown, they are very happy with the light rail patrol that's currently there, and they're very supportive of it as well. And Vice Mayor Kavanaugh articulated it very well in saying that I think this is not so much a want, but I think it is a need for our community, given that light rail is here to stay and that we will be continuing onward.
Thank you. Mr. Finter.
Well, I appreciate the presentation. In fact, are you up for questions now, or is that where we're at?
Yes, we are.
Okay, good. I didn't want to interrupt you. So it indicates a lot of great people doing good work over at the police department every day, trying their best to deliver. And, you know, just a little history. In 2008, when we went through the Great Recession, we were already running pretty lean. We'd had years and years of doing less with less. And then so one of the innovative ways that city management brought to us was the COPS grant, and that was to get officers on the street. And I don't remember exactly, about 100 officers, or you're right. But the idea was that grant would end at some point, and we would somehow phase those officers in through attrition and other areas. And we did that. So we were able to put a Band-Aid on a pretty lean operation to begin with already. And one of the things I've learned from being in the community, a simple truth is that people want to feel safe in their homes. They want to feel safe in the streets. They want to know that crime is down. And from the statistics, there's an amazing job being accomplished, probably through the stress and strain of a lot of good workers trying to do their best with less. And so I would suggest to you, one of the narratives that's out there, and all of us ride along, we look at the police department, it's the biggest budget within the city, and we always want to make sure that we're responding to the folks in the community that want to feel safe. What I've heard back is we are running so lean that we are starting to stress the system. And one of those indicators is, and I'm told, I don't have a radio, so I couldn't tell you, is any unit to break. And when you show that slide there that shows the amount of time responding to calls versus being proactive, which I appreciate Councilmember Glover and the Vice Mayor talking about, the reactive, we have been so reactive for so many years that I think we're missing a big chunk of what needs to be accomplished in the community. And so this is a kind of a long question, but a little bit of a narrative or a little bit of a soapbox to begin with. I've seen indications, without going into detail, that we're stressing the system. I think it, for the officers in the street, we're stressing them to run from call to call to call on those really serious calls. And there's more than people would ever think in this wonderful community of Mesa, that officers are trying to back up each other and having long long distances to respond. And sometimes that can lead to safety concerns. I think we've been very fortunate to see all the good work coming out of the police department on a pretty lean system. And so when I look at your future needs, I'm worried I'm not hearing back from what I think the narrative is out there, that we've stretched the system so far, almost to the point of breaking in some areas, that we are not truly taking care of that officer on the street responding to the citizen proactively at times, a lot of the times, and being able to keep them safe, even though our crime stats are down. Tell me what your feelings are, if you would, chiefs, or any of the chiefs. And am I wrong in what I'm sharing with you?
And I appreciate your comments, and I think the slide says future needs. I mean, the programs we're presenting actually is what we feel we need right now. So I'll do a quick narrative to your question, and then I know Chief Filler probably will have some things to fill in as well from the patrol perspective. But we call it multiple points of failure. We do think the system is stretched, you know, quite severely in terms of what all the things that we're doing. And I think it's, like you said, it's a credit to the men and women that are outperforming and doing a great job in the field. But there is a point where the investment to assist them is really important. When you look at the staffing over time, and we are down about 97 officers from 08-09 and about 137 civilians from 08-09. And we used to carry we carried a ratio of about 60-40 sworn to civilian professional staff as a matter of generally right in that range. That was one of the most robust ratios because we've always been very conscious of having civilian and professional staff support so the officers are out in the field doing what's most appropriate to their skill sets. So when you talk about 234 positions over that time, that includes both sworn and civilian, obviously you're absorbing all those duties, not just what is done in the field. So with that, I think when we're talking about the staffing model going forward, I think that is why it's of critical nature, in our opinion, to get back some assistance so that we don't get to points where it's falling apart. We are sustaining, but there is a lot of stretch. The calls for service and those ratios you saw are real. 43% to calls when we should be 33 is hard, which means we are running throughout the city. And we do a fabulous job. However, as you said, there is a point where that's not going to effectively be able to be maintained for long term. So there's certainly a lot of that. And I'll let Chief Filler add a few comments since he has more of the patrol's perspective for you.
Good morning, Mayor Giles and members of the council. Councilman Fincher, I would agree with you
wholeheartedly. It's been a little difficult with our numbers being what they are, with crime being down, with our arrests being up, with the proactive activity is actually elevated, but with minimal resources. And one of the arguments that I make is the reputation of this organization, of the police department, is about fourfold. It's going to be dispatch, your first point of contact with a 911 operator. It's going to be the patrol officer that responds to your house or to your call for service, the traffic unit, and our crime prevention folks. And we can't spend that extra minute, and having operations, the emphasis has been, hey, spend the extra minute with our constituents. That may be the first time they ever met a police officer. And I have a personal experience when the light went on for me when I was fairly new about trying to go to another call, and I thought, I think this victim just wants to talk to me for half of an hour. So as we've encouraged that to happen, then the radio does go to any unit to break. And so it's a mixed message to our members of spend the extra time with our citizens. That's where the opinion comes from. That's where we can satisfy their needs, and it might be a quality of life issue by asking a couple extra questions. And then that any unit to break comes out. We've had an elevated phase one dispatching, where priority two calls are all their dispatch because there's problems in the city. So the numbers are hard to argue with, but we're not whole. We do need more resources. And again, the future of the organization, yesterday at the awards ceremony, 129 Mesa personnel on the police side have 15 to 30 years experience and were recognized. They're going to depart soon. and the future of the organization is our younger generation. And right now, we're barely getting them to mandatory training on overtime. We're not getting them to the significant cases and the training that they need to have to develop them to take our seats down the road or move to detectives or specialty assignments. So that's the part that's being missed and trouble getting time off. Again, there's only three areas in the department that have critical staffing. It's communications, it's the holding facility, and it's patrol. When we fall below, it's also an expensive issue on overtime at a 50% credit card. So staffing is very expensive. If we're have no agility, and again, our members, it may not show up in the numbers, but there's a definite difficulty right now with our staff and struggling with morale to get folks to training and also get them time off.
Okay, I think Chief Solberg, I think.
Mayor, if I could add one thing to what Chief Miller just said.
Looking at our future attrition, currently as of today, 17% of our department is eligible to retire. Out of that percentage, 57 of those are in drop now and will leave within 5 years, and that's 45% of that prior number. But a more telling picture, I ran the numbers for up to 2021. So within the next 5 years, 45% of our department is eligible, will have 20 years or more. So they'll be eligible to retire. And that's not counting those who are in drop now that we know are going to go within 5 years. So within 5 years, almost half of our department could walk out the door if they chose to.
If I could follow up, Mayor. Thank you, Chiefs. And just so you know, I think we, and I, again, the presentation was wonderful. We have some underlying challenges that are not coming forward. I'm telling you, I have no agendas other than make sure that Mesa is safe. I'm concerned. I don't think we have the staffing we need in the field. I'm worried. We have seen some symptoms that come through the council when we talk about litigation and other areas that have been an indicator to me that we probably need to address some areas. I am all about efficient government, but I think we are now just at a tipping point that needs to be addressed in staffing, the boots on the ground, in the street, especially with the officers, when we talk about officer safety, when we talk about safety in the community, what the citizens are feeling. So I would hope, and I know we need to hear from others, I apologize taking so much time, that the city manager is going to be able to come back with a plan or suggestions or something that not just including light rail staffing, but throughout the city where we really address what I would say is a critical need to take care of some things. So.
Thank you. Mr. Cavanaugh.
Thank you. Again, excellent presentation, and I really appreciate it. Hearing your presentation combined with what we heard from the fire department previously really tells us that innovation and creativity can't do it all. Staffing resources are a critical component for officer safety, public safety, and those are really important elements. Again, as Councilmember Fincher said, putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. We've worked pretty hard. It's like our streets department trying to, you know, glue the streets together until they need a rebuild. And with all the officers leaving and retiring in the next couple of years, it's time for a rebuild of that street. And we have to have the resources to do that. And that's very important because clearly what I see, so many of our veteran officers here, 15 years and more, they have had outstanding training, and their responses to incidents are show evidence of that training. But sadly, I think we've seen some incidents in the recent past where the disparity in training is has shown, and so the community pays a price for that. And so it is something that we really need to address system-wide for our public safety departments. Because again, your two departments are regarded as some of the best and most innovative and creative in the country in terms of what you do. The lab program is probably the best in the nation in terms of what it does. You know, our lab didn't appear on the front of USA Today about not testing rape kits, you know. So what I think is that the discussion is very timely. 18 years ago, next month, Mesa voters looked at a quality of life initiative. They told us what was important to the community. They said public safety was critically important. And they voted for a dedicated sales tax portion to go to increase staffing for police and fire. And we continue to benefit from that decision by voters 18 years ago. And looking, and I think the mayor has said it before, it's not an expense problem, it's a revenue problem that we're dealing with here. And I think we need to look at options for revenue. We know that there are initiatives in the community to ask us to look at a dedicated sales tax to provide additional staffing for police and fire. And I think we need to take that seriously, and we need to look at it very soon. So I trust, you know, Mr. Brady will be able to. I know he's very aware of that issue, and I know that he and his financial staff can come back to us to show us what the impacts could be among the various options that we hear that are floated in the community. Because it is really, we know that when we tell Mesa voters, here's a proposal, here's what we're going to do with it, and we follow through and we show them. You know, the phrase Mr. Brady teases me all the time is promises made, promises kept. Well, I think the investment in public safety made 18 years ago has paid immense dividends over that time for public safety and all the successes that you've had. But I think it's time to renew that promise, renew those resources. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. You guys do a great job. I love the attitude and the atmosphere of police leadership, that you guys do the best that you can with what we give you and you don't complain. But in spite of that lack of being really good at complaining, I think we've all caught on to the fact that there's some real needs here. So thank you for the great job you do. In spite of the resource challenges you have, to be able to say crime is down, arrests are up, wow, you know, that's amazing that you get good results with limited resources. So thank you. I think it's clear that we need more police officers and that we need better trained police officers. And you can't have one, you know, without the other. The emphasis on de-escalation, I love to hear it, and I'm anxious to do what I can to help support that effort. The phrase that I think I'll take away from this is multiple points of failure. That's not what we want in our public safety system. That we need to do everything we can to have that not be the description of you know, trying to do the best with what you have. So we as a city government, we as elected officials, we as voters need to give you the resources you need. So this, I share the concern that's been expressed. To me, from my vantage point, it's clear that this is our number one priority as a community, is figuring out how to better fund our public safety personnel and to have the resources and the personnel that you need to do your job effectively. So I join with my fellow council members in asking city management to give us some choices so that we can make some recommendations to the voters to solve the situation. So thank you very much. The last question I have for you is, and we're asking all the departments, you know, we're placing more emphasis on metrics and what could and should we be, what numbers coming out of your department ought we to be paying attention to. You guys kind of set the standard. The CompStat model is being applied in other departments, and I think we'd like to try that model citywide. So what are the critical numbers? When you have your CompStat meetings, what are the metrics that are the most important to you as you measure the success of your department?
Yeah, I think it starts with the crime rate. That's the first thing that people want to know, is whether they're safe, perceived or not. What are the exact numbers?
And the numbers we use are UCR numbers from the federal government. It's a standard, so they're validated where we are. So that's kind of been a metric that we've had for a long time. A lot of things that we do aren't tangible, but a lot of them are. So where we are with Part 1 crimes for the 28-day cycle, where we are year to date from 14 to 15 or 15 to 13. So fatal accidents, for example, we remained even at 19, but in 2013 there was another 10. I think we were at 23. So it's really keeping track of those trends that occur, and it's through a crime analyst commitment with numbers. So crime analysts at the districts keep track of the numbers so we know if we're going up or down. We use mapping. So there's mapping to show if there's clusters of crime. And it's real time, weekly in the districts and daily, and then monthly. We have an assembly where we talk about what's going up, what's going down. are there any trends, are there any serial crimes? So we measure crime rates, we measure arrest rates relative to crime. Having the operations component, one of my big theories and my fundamental premise is nobody's made a better decision when they were impaired. So there's a high emphasis on illegal drug activity and our alcohol arrests. Both were up last year, and I think that's paid dividends. And then a very significant emphasis on my behalf on proactive activity. You go back to policing in the 70s, 80s, it was very reactionary. You might have been in a building for a call to come out, then you respond. Now we know where to go, where the problem people are, where we're having a high crime area, and trying to interact with folks earlier before a crime could be committed, whether it's the lab gets a hit or we get good detective or police work. So we're working smarter with the CompStat model with less resources, and it really just keeps track every 28 days of where we are. From accidents to crime to arrests and any other trends that are affecting the city.
Thank you very much. Council, any additional questions for these gentlemen? Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you for the good job you're doing. The next item on our agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the City Council's strategic priority of placemaking and the related departmental proposed budgets. Cindy, good to see you.
Good morning. Let's see if I can. Okay. Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council members, City Management staff. My name is Cindy Ornstein, and I am the Director of Arts and Culture, and one of four presentations that are part of this. This larger presentation on the strategic priority of placemaking. So I'm kicking it off, and in my five slides and few minutes, I hope I can share a lot of information. First of all, before I go into the specifics of my department, I thought since I'm first on this presentation, it would be helpful to share a definition I found that seems to be used again and again for what placemaking is and for the public at home to understand the context of what this presentation is about. Placemaking being a priority that the council has identified that it wants the city to work on. Placemaking is defined as a multifaceted approach to the planning, design, and management of public spaces that capitalizes on a local community's assets, inspiration, and potential with the intention of creating public spaces that promote people's health, happiness, and well-being. So I guess I would say that in a sense we're a piece of the prevention side of the presentation we just heard in terms of creating an environment that is going to promote the well-being of our citizens and hopefully help us have a safer community and a happier community. There's a subset of placemaking called creative placemaking, which my department obviously is quite involved in, and that is using art and artists and arts and cultural experiences at the core, sort of the power of those experiences as change agents in a community. So our department logo says at the bottom of it, inspiring creativity and discovery. And I want to share in a general way that these are not just about exterior public spaces. They're about, in creative placemaking, creative places to play, learn, and explore, engaging the public in active participation, enhancing civic participation. So beyond what we do, creating an environment where people want to be engaged in all aspects of their community, and helping to connect people's ideas and creative thinking to community problem solving. That's an essential part of the view of creative placemaking, so that you can take cultural experiences in the arts and use them for all kinds of community issues, everything from student success to preserving our natural and cultural resources and people's connection to those resources, enhancing the lives of children, especially at-risk children, older adults, those with special needs, and creating opportunities for cross-cultural understanding. So thinking broadly about the impact we have on the community. And we want to, before we continue, say thank you to our staff in the Arts and Culture Department who work so very hard, and to the City of Mesa for its support of the work we do. We really, really appreciate that. So this first page has an overview with subcategories of contributing areas of activity to show the participation, that's the per visit growth and changes in our different areas. I'd like to draw attention to the tiny numbers at the bottom of the screen, because it does show that as an overall, as a department, in the 4 years, we've seen over 10% growth, with last fiscal year, total participation of 680,788 visits. That is a record. That is the largest participation we've had in the history of the department, and we're very pleased with that. There are going to be a couple of anomalies. You'll see as you go along, you won't see straight lines, and that's because, of course, we're a department of programs, and programs and activities and events change every year. So key things that can impact us, for instance, you see a very large spike in event services in fiscal year 11-12. We happen to have a little thing called the CNN GOP debate and 3 days of activities that brought a lot of people to events we were involved in that spiked that number, along with a number of other things that went on at that year. Or similarly, when you look under festivals, you see a big spike in 12-13. We brought amazing dinosaur puppets from Australia that brought 40,000 people to the Mesa Arts Center campus that spiked that number that year. But overall, the growth trend is good, and we're very pleased with it. This growth is founded in several key focal areas. One is collaborations on public art and events. We have a lot of great partners in the community, and that's been very important. Partnerships with DMA, NEDCO, Mesa Urban Garden, ASU, the colleges that are currently located in downtown, and so many other organizations. And a real focus on improved activities, exhibits, and interactivity that will delight and attract new audiences. These charts have a lot of information, so I think I'll just focus on a few key aspects that I want to share, which is that overall we are seeing the trend is very nice growth at Mesa Arts Center. If you were to look at a longer history here, you would see even more growth, because in the going back to 9-10, our participation number was about 287,000, and last year it was 452,000. At the Arizona Museum of Natural History, I wanted to point out that you seem to see a slight downward trend. That actually was, in a sense, somewhat planned. Arizona Museum of Natural History, with very limited staff since the cuts a number of years ago, was very focused on building the program at Mesa, opening and building the program at Mesa Grande, which took a lot of staff effort, planning and implementing some major exhibit enhancements, which have now taken place over the past couple of years. And this is paying off. We don't see this year because we don't have a complete fiscal year, but this year already, the Museum of Natural History is currently 21% up over the prior year. Their year-to-date participation has increased 17,000 over the prior year at this time, and they are on track to have actually a record year in revenues and close to a record year in participation. So we are very happy about the investment of their time and effort to move creating a foundation for future growth.
City Minister Kavanaugh has a question.
Yes.
I appreciate that. I know the increase is evident this year at the Museum of Natural History, and they I think have very positive things going for them. They have merged their support organizations into one foundation that would like to focus its efforts, its fundraising efforts, on funding new exhibits, new programming at the museum, which I think is critically important and a perfect role for a foundation to play. You add to that you have about 270 volunteers for this museum alone, which is, again, is remarkable, and I think has contributed to the ability of this museum to flourish despite the severe cutbacks that we've had. One of the issues or requests that the council has heard this spring from the foundation that supports the museum is to have its volunteer coordinator position be in the same posture as every other volunteer coordinator position in every other department of the city. The foundation stepped in to support that position in the downturn, and it's a position that is part-time without benefits. And so at least one of the issues I'm hoping that we will consider as a council in terms of the budget is to treat that position as your volunteer coordinator at the MAC and at the IDEA Museum and again, every other department, because when you have a foundation such as this museum has, you and I know that grantors do not like to sponsor and pay for staff. They want to pay for programs, exhibits, and things like that. So I'm hoping as we move forward in the discussion, I think it will help enhance the work of the museum, enhance the revenues as we're able to focus on new exhibits, very creative exhibits from the wonderful collections they're acquiring, to be able to, as museums all must do, is change exhibits fairly frequently. And that was one of the casualties of the downturn, is that we've had static exhibits for a long periods of time, and you want to encourage people to come back. So I think this is a great example of, again, creativity, innovation, use of volunteers, and use of support from your private foundation. So I'm hoping as we continue on with the budget process, colleagues, that we look at that issue, because I think our investment in the volunteer position from the city will end up producing returns on that investment for increased grants and revenues for exhibits, which will drive revenues up. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Vice Mayor. That leads beautifully into a comment I was going to make about the labor-intensive nature of the things our department does, and volunteers are a huge part of that, especially the large number of volunteers who actually participate in exhibit creation at the Museum of Natural History. Our department uses art, artifacts, tools, materials, and literally builds experiences for people. And so we do create a gathering place for citizens, which is part of placemaking, but we also literally are, it's very labor intensive to create the experiences and activities that are offered and the exhibits. So thank you. That volunteer coordinator position is very critical.
Cindy, I think, though, we've brought that up, but I think Mayor and Council, so I think it would be good to have Mr. Wilson weigh in on that, because I've asked him that same question about how he has additional revenues and how he would best like to program those. So maybe we should both bring him into the conversation about where he thinks, how he can accommodate that service.
Sure.
Is he here?
I'm not sure if Tom's here.
So maybe
here
in the
morning,
future we could do that.
But I can say that he is currently working on a proposal related to his enhanced revenues. He's had significantly enhanced revenues this year, and so he is putting a proposal together that includes how some of those could assist with making this happen. So, IDEA Museum, everybody's heard multiple times about the wonderful success since the IDEA Museum launched its new brand. That success continues. The growth of the new brands has been supported by strategically focused exhibits around their slogan, which is for your child and the child within you. And really that is, I think, important to what you experience at this museum now, which is really almost equally engaging to adults as it is to children. There's a broad array of subject matter. There are experiences indoors and outdoors. We see in the picture that there are things created again by our exhibit staff inside, but there are also these wonderful musical instruments in front of the museum. The number of activities they're incorporating into what they do are quite extraordinary. Their exhibits are, have upward of 25, 26 hands-on activities now. And they are partnering in ways that are very important to the city. The middle picture is from this year's very, very successful Southwest Maker Fest, with which our department was involved in as a partner. So we're very pleased with the direction and the engagement of citizenry at the Idea Museum. I did want to mention that as we are experiencing record growth and record attendance at the Idea Museum, I should also give a nod back to natural history. I believe it was last month, for the first time ever, they had a $100,000 earned revenue achievement for one month. It was the first time they've done it in the history of the museum. So that is a sign of the growth that I was talking about. Now I'm celebrating through pictures that I'll run through fairly quickly to just sort of give a nod to the many, many ways our department tries to address the notion of placemaking and creative placemaking. Everything from the hugely successful dinosaur egg hunts, which are represented by the little darling at the left corner of the screen, to the street pianos project that we celebrated this year as part of our 10th anniversary at Mesa Arts Center, that was a beautiful example of community partnering, working with 24 artists and 24 community groups throughout our community to create these playable experiences out on the streets of Mesa throughout our community. Beer and Bones, there's a picture in the upper right, that's the wonderful for adult audiences party that was just held last week at the Arizona Museum of Natural History. And I haven't gotten the number yet. Last year they had 700 people. They were still tallying, but I know their goal was to have 1,000 people this year, and it was packed and very successful.
So, yeah, no, Mr. Kavanaugh has a question.
Yeah, and I guess more of a comment. These pictures are highly illustrative of placemaking. And there's one picture I wish you had added, but it's a new mural on the side of the Mesa Arts Center building in conjunction with the exhibit there. I've heard amazing feedback and comments from that in terms of, again, the sense of place, arrival, and belonging that people see, an affinity towards that. And I think that is a wonderful addition to the Mesa Arts Center, and I certainly hope it stays long after its exhibit goes.
Thank you for that. I didn't include that picture, but I just got an email yesterday from a staff member reporting to me that the artist had posted on Instagram, and there was this flood of hundreds of responses to the photo he posted of his mural, and we've been seeing a lot of activity on social media, and it's pages and pages of positive responses, so we're very excited about that. Thank you for that. And then, of course, Mesa Grande, which has been developing beautifully as an educational and community resource, and we're very excited about that. All of these are creating places that draw new people to participate and encourage deeper ownership for existing patrons, and I did want to say that they're building places that attract and support a creative economy, something I think that we can be at the forefront of. It is the creative economy as a whole, for-profit and nonprofit, is one of the fastest growing segments of the global economy, and I think Mesa is very well positioned to take advantage of opportunities that creates. And then we have pictures that are from, these are Mesa Arts Center pictures. Three out of the four are from our recent Spark Festival, really giving a sense of the kind of play, experimentation, and making magic that happens when the community gets to come together and experiment and participate in creative activities. The campus was really magically lit this year for Spark, and there were so many interactives. It was very exciting. And then at the lower right, if you haven't had a chance yet to play with our new interactive musical Shadows, one of the surprises and wonderful experiences we discovered was that if you, we opened it with a dance piece that was commissioned by, from an ASU graduate student, and it was fantastic and wonderfully gratifying to see the way the music became the score, as if the dance had been made to a score of music, but in fact the music was totally responsive to the dance and to the movement of the user. So we actually came up with the idea of exploring having local dance companies come in and set pieces on Musical Shadows this coming year, so we can see them make music while they dance. And the final slide is a budget slide. It capitalizes the total budget and the funds that it comes from. This past year, the Arts and Cultural Fund was created to enable us to try to see the building of potential reserves that can be used to reinvest back in the work that the department does. One of the things that I want to point out, most of these slides you see don't have revenues on them, and I don't know that we've presented those before, but we did want to show that the revenues that we're bringing in are substantial, almost half of the costs of our programs, and this despite the fact that we do provide many, many free programs to the schools and to the community and free events. We wanted to emphasize that this is an important, we think, investment of the city of Mesa, and we thank you for that investment. This is the coming year's budget. It would be $7,625,000 that the city is investing in these programs that served 680,000 visits this past year. Like libraries and parks, the city is investing through arts and culture in learning, quality of life, placemaking, creative economy development, and community development. And we do take our side of this very seriously, this responsibility to support arts and culture. And in addition to strong earned revenue, I did want to mention that we are focusing a lot of effort on trying to build our contributed income in the coming year and the coming several years. We have some new development staff at MAC who we think have great great skills that they're bringing to bear. The Idea Museum just got a very large grant from the Piper Trust to expand their development capacity. And the combination of the two support organizations at Natural History, also all three provide good foundations for future success and growth in contributed income. The last thing I want to say before I turn the mic over is that we are really excited about the confluence of what is happening now in Mesa, projects, activities, and opportunities for the future. We are currently piloting a new third Saturday night event. The second one will happen May 21st. The first one was phenomenally successful. We just got a $75,000 grant from the NEA, from their Our Town Creative Placemaking Program, that will be for a project collaborating with city staff and the DMA and NEDCO to put on a prototyping festival for using artists and designers and architects to look at solutions to connectivity in downtown and around downtown. And we are really, really excited about the future development opportunities of the ASU partnership. I've been in discussion with the Herberger Institute about opportunities they're looking at for programs to bring here, and I have to say I am extremely excited about the synergies that are likely to be created and the opportunities for community and economic development as a result of that partnership. So thank you for your leadership in moving that forward. I think it's going to be a very important catalyst for the next phase of development. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Cindy. Great presentation. I think we're all fans, as you know.
Thank you. And I will now turn the mic over to Mark Hirschberg.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. Morning. Taking a cue from the arts, I would be Act Two, Scene Two. obviously, Parks, Recreation, Community Facilities, a department with a diverse portfolio of
different offerings for the community and services for the community for the purposes of placemaking and the role we play in that arena. We'll be this presentation will focus on recreation centers, our community facilities, park development, and special events. Much like Cindy noted, and as a follow-up to PD, we really view ourselves as part of that preventive nature of our community and providing health and safety opportunities and places for people to recreate and go to during their leisure time and their downtime. And we really focus on increasing the citizen utilization of our programs and facilities, creating more park and open space development throughout the city for people to recreate in. And of course, a focus on continuous service delivery, customer service, and to accomplish that, we need to continue to focus on increasing our outreach and marketing efforts. This pie chart represents our attendance over the year 2015 and breaks down by category, but as a whole, we served over 1 million people through our programs. And I think what's important to show is that in the citywide events and an additional 10,000 participants through our mobile recreation unit, Fun and Fitness, we're not just asking people to come to us. We're taking programs and events out to the community that can't reach us in underserved areas and trying to really work with those parts of the community to provide them leisure opportunities to participate. It also doesn't include our community youth groups and our aquatics coalition groups. Last year alone, we worked with 20 different partner groups in our community youth groups. Those are the Little Leagues, the Pop Warner, and youth football groups, the soccer organizations, et cetera. And we provided nearly 77,000 field reservations for those groups at 25 different locations on 75 separate fields. And also worked with 6 different aquatic user groups, serving an additional 800 users in those programs. Also, that million plus serve does not include the more than 2,000 participants that work with Arizona Disabled Sports and utilize the Broadway Recreation Center, as well as those that are using services provided by Step Up Schools at the Washington Activity Center. So, a lot of great service out there, and a lot of people using our services and facilities throughout the course of time. We continue to see an increase in our attendance and participation. You'll see the dark green there represents 2013. The lighter green represents 2015. That first line where you see a slight dip in attendance is our recreation center. And that's simply due to some larger groups that participated at the Red Mountain Center, utilizing it for event rentals and stuff, and just simply outgrew the space for their events. So we saw a slight decrease there in 2014. But from a participation standpoint, as you'll see on the next slide, we continue to see great utilization of our recreation centers. Also wanted to point out that as we're in that busy time of registration for summer activities now, we started our first our registration for residents on April 11th. On that day, we offered 2,000 recreation programs, different opportunities for people to register and participate. In that one day alone, we had more than 1,500 enrollments occur. And by Wednesday of that week, some of our most popular programs were already full and on wait lists. So obviously, a great demand and great utilization of those programs, and people are literally online at midnight trying to get into the programs they want. Again, I talked about the recreation centers and that slight dip in attendance there, but you'll see that the dark green there is the Red Mountain Center, and with that's all of its amenities and offerings, that's obviously our most popular recreation center. And that attendance and usage continues to increase. And then Webster and Jefferson continue to be consistent, and our staff at those facilities do a great job of listening to the community on those needs of the to really serve that after-school time frame when mom and dad or caretaker is at work, and trying to give those kids a safe place to recreate and get their homework done and everything else during those hours. So consistent usage there. As the economy continues to recover, we see increased usage and utilization of the the convention center and the amphitheater. You can see those numbers continue to rise and grow, and we're excited to see that happen, and obviously great utilization of that facility. Park acreage development. That dark green represents the first column there is 2010, and the dark green represents the undeveloped acres that we had in our inventory, and the lighter green is our developed acres. You can obviously see through the parks bond, we continue to increase the amount of developed acres, and that inventory of available space continues to, available land for future development continues to decrease. So again, providing access and opportunities for people to recreate, and we continue to see that area continue to grow. From a budget standpoint, the department's total budget is $39,747,814. Of that, $30,438,000 is parks and recreation related. The additional $9,309,000 is related to facilities maintenance, which our department became one in October of this past year. So we continue to manage those facilities and those funds. Some of the trends we see, partnerships and collaborations, I continue to mention some of our programs are full already, you know, some of those popular programs. So those partnerships are essential. Working with those different community user groups is essential to providing opportunities for the community because we can't do it all on our own, and we need to continue to build those relationships. Active adventure play opportunities ever since the Riverview Playground was built. We continue to get requests throughout the community whenever we're going out there to build the next Riverview. And what adventure-type play can we come up with, whether it was, and it's not just Riverview, it's also Fountain Plaza and the need for additional skate parks. It's the Desert Trails Park and the success of the BMX community and the mountain bike community and providing those opportunities as well. It was just...
Mr. Hirschberg, yes, Mr. Kavanaugh.
I really appreciate the description of the trends because it reflects the just again the great innovation and work that your staff is doing in responding to the needs of the community. And one of the things I would like you just at least to mention is there's an exciting new thing happening at Dobson Park. Again, I think it's important for while we're on TV for the community to know. Again, something that I mean you have an award-winning department, but it truly shows you've got a commitment for everyone in the community.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, thank you. Yes, we are working on a playground replacement at Dobson Ranch Park, and this will be our first 100% inclusive playground, meaning wheelchairs can fit on the platforms. There'll be activities and different modules for children with autism or speech mutation issues. It'll be sensory things. It'll be active play so that people can truly recreate together. One of the most popular features that we've seen, again, a feed off of Riverview, was the mini zip line. We'll have a zip line at Dobson Ranch Park that will have one for able-bodied and one where you can do a transfer out of a wheelchair so that everybody can experience the sensation of flight and speed. So very exciting project. Unfortunately, we're a little bit behind. We're at 90% design and quickly moving forward. So hopefully by we can get that done through the heat of the summer and then come back in the fall and have a great playground. And we look forward to rededicating that playground and opening that as a great amenity for all of the members of our community.
Great.
It was just a short 5 years ago that we put in our first shade over a playground in a public park and is now probably the next to adventure play. Or side by side is probably the number one most requested amenity when we go meet with the community. Even on existing playgrounds why don't you have shade over this playground? So we continue to try and address that need and look for grant opportunities to do that and everything possible. And when we have the opportunity to rebuild playgrounds, especially larger community parks trying to install and regional parks trying to install the shade over the playgrounds there. Again, citizen communication and engagement. I mentioned the speed at which those programs filled on that first week of registration. New this year, we went to a fully digital program called Jump In, which was a catalog of all of our offerings with a direct link to all of the program straight into the registration system. That was posted 4 weeks before our registration went live, and in that time, we had over 30,000 clicks opening the brochure with an average read time of 5 minutes and 46 seconds. Of those people that read it and clicked on it, 1,500 of them were a direct click into the registration system. So I think that's a reflection of the success of the digital marketing and getting the word out there in our social media of promoting those types of
features that are available and how to communicate with the public. And should also note, of all those registrations that occurred, 90% of them did occur on through our online registration system. So great utilization there. The future and where are we headed? We've heard, and you all have heard directly from independent citizens and various user groups, the need for increased sports facilities. We've heard about the need for increased recreation opportunities in indoor spaces, and how do we provide those? We still have, we've made significant investments over the last 4 years in the park system. We've invested more than, that $70 million bond was an infusion that hasn't been seen in the park system in this community in over 35 years. And we've seen by the community meetings and the reaction of when we open things, how much people enjoy that investment and how much they're utilizing it and how much they want more. We still need to, through that program, we also address some critical aging infrastructure, and we need to continue to keep up with that and address that aging infrastructure. With so many needs out there, and the opportunities truly are endless to provide more and to continue to enhance, I believe it's in our best interest to go back to the community and ask them what's next and where do we head and what's the true demands and the true needs and wants of the community. And I think it would be prudent of us to do that through an updated strategic plan, which includes a community needs assessment and surveying the community and focus groups asking what direction we should take in the future. That's the end of my presentation and close on that comment, and happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mark. So is the needs assessment that you're talking about, that obviously there's some costs involved in surveying and getting collecting people's opinions, and is that part of your proposed budget, or is...
Yes, Mayor. I estimate that would cost approximately $150,000 to do the community survey and needs assessment, gather and interpret all those results, and then come back and craft that all into a strategic plan of how to move forward. And yes, that is included in our proposed budget.
Great. I couldn't agree with you more. It's great what you've done. The infusion of capital and the new projects is wonderful, but it seems to have only whet the appetite of the public. I get lobbied every time I step out my door or turn on my computer for more lighted ball fields and practice fields and soccer fields, and I don't think there is a quenchable desire for those facilities, but we're not satisfying the demand in spite of all the money and the resources that we're dedicating to it. So I wholeheartedly agree with the need for a needs assessment so we can prioritize what we need and how to best do that. But thank you, Council. Any additional questions for Mr. Hirschberg? Thank you, Mark. Great job.
Thank you.
Jody, I think, is next. Hi, Jody.
Good morning, Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Jody Sorrell with Transit Services. Here this morning just to talk a little bit about what's going on in Wind Transit and our budget. This is our ridership in Mesa, our transit ridership in Mesa through February of this year. And just so you know, the reason it's through February is the data we get from Valley Metro comes a month after the end of the month. So we're just now getting our March ridership data. But this year's, so far we've taken over 4.3 million trips on transit combined. And we will, last year we took about 6.3 million. We're going to come in a little under that this year. A big part of that is the low gas prices have, our bus ridership has gone down a little bit. But on the other hand, our light rail ridership with the addition of three more miles has increased. So our light rail ridership this year should end somewhere around 2 million trips, which is a significant increase, almost double what we did last year. An item that typically is a lot of interest is our dial-a-ride ridership. We should end the year about 115,000 dial-a-ride trips in Mesa. And in the East Valley region, in Scottsdale, Tempe, Chandler, Gilbert, and Mesa, Mesa provides about 40% of all the dial-a-ride trips taken in that region.
Jody, Mr. Cavanaugh has a question.
A question to that point, in terms of dial-a-ride, there's some changes becoming effective July 1 in terms of transfers and things like that, making it easier, eliminating transfers.
Correct.
For dial-a-ride folks. How do you view that as impacting ridership or for your coming budget year?
What we've done, so in our dial-a-ride system right now, If you need to transfer from the East Valley into Phoenix, you have to, if you have need to go from like Mesa to somewhere in Phoenix, you have to transfer. So you have to transfer from East Valley Dial-A-Ride to Phoenix Dial-A-Ride. And that's been a point of contention for our riders for a long time, because that can add an hour onto an already existing two-hour trip on Dial-A-Ride. The RPTA board this last spring took a very progressive action, and we eliminated transfers. So now somebody in Mesa who has to go into Phoenix, it's one continuous trip. It's right now, so the estimates that came out of that study and that recommendation, the worst case scenario that they're expecting is that looking at right now what our transfers are, that that transfer number could increase by 40%. So what we've done, is, and I'll talk about this later in the slide a little bit, is Mesa gets, in addition to the general fund contribution that is made to support transit, we get about $11 million from Prop 400 to support transit. About $3 million of that is for Dial-A-Ride specifically. We've programmed some additional funds from that Prop 400 fund money to cover those costs. So, and that's an issue that for all the cities in the valley, that's a concern, because we're doing the right thing for our Dial-A-Ride riders, but we're kind of not sure what that's going to do for our budget. So almost all of us are taking it out of our Prop 400 money instead of impacting the general fund money. So we'll be watching those, and I can get back and talk to you about that when we have some more data.
Thank you. Mr. Fender.
And hopefully you'll talk about some of the less expensive alternatives that are in Dial-A-Ride, ride sharing, others. We've been trying for years to, you know, it would be nice if they came up with an Uber for Dial-A-Ride. Well, and maybe you're getting to that.
Well, we're looking at it. So one of the things that we'll be talking about in the next year is our current Dial-A-Ride model, the current provider contract, that is up for bid with Valley Metro this year. So we've looked at what we have now. So we've kind of done the extreme on Dial-A-Ride, which is it's a shared trip on a cutaway van, and it can take 2 hours, to going to a cab model where you pretty much go directly to where you're going. It costs less. It costs about the same because more riders are taking it, but you're giving more riders trips. The RFP they'll go out will be something of a hybrid, because what we found is a cab is more effective for the shorter trips, but for the longer trips, a van and a shared trip is more cost effective. So we've looked at that. We've talked to vendors. We had Valley Metro had 8 vendors come and meet with them and kind of talk about the different things. So we'll get down to that, and then that will help us our ride choice program, which is residents can buy $10 worth of cab script for $3. That will help we're also going to make changes to that, kind of make that more attractive, because right now what people are doing is they're using the ride choice program as a fallback if they can't make the Dial-A-Ride trip, and we'd rather have them take the ride choice program rather than the Dial-A-Ride trip. A Dial-A-Ride trip costs us about $28 a trip. That's after you take out the fare. And a ride choice trip costs us about $15 a trip. So we'd like more people to take the ride choice program. This is our light rail ridership, and this is part of some statistics we're watching as part of the What Works City initiative. So since light rail opened, so far this fiscal year, we're at about 1.3 million trips. And then the colors at the bottom going east to west are the ridership at the different stations. So obviously Mesa Drive, and we're seeing some very interesting things. So Mesa Drive has become much more of a park and ride connecting station. People will drive to it and connect from there. Sycamore still has a lot of ridership, and a big part of that is Sycamore has always been very much people transferring from bus to rail. With the number of bus routes that go in there. And what this is really showing us is that it's so high as those bus routes that go into it. There's 4 right now since we opened Central Mesa. University Dobson and Broadway are 2 of those 3. So really our parallel east-west streets have a lot of riders connecting into light rail at Sycamore. And that's good news. And as we open to Gilbert Road, that connection will be changed to Gilbert Road in most cases, so that will just increase some of that ridership at that station. So as part of our Transit Master Plan and one of our priorities into looking at serving, kind of increasing service to some of our activity centers. Last year, as part of our budget, we did a pilot program to modify the Buzz, which is our neighborhood circulator route, to go further west from Alma School and to go into Riverview and serve that facility. And as you see, as you can see, the change, that service went into effect late October of last year, and it's had a definite change on ridership. December definitely spiked with people going into Riverview, and so we're, for this fiscal year moving forward, we'd like to keep that extension going into Riverview and keep that connection going for people wanting to shop or work.
Mr. Cavanaugh.
Thank you. Again, yesterday the mayor and I attended a very informative presentation by ASU students looking at downtown and looking at their recommendations and desires for millennials and students. And one of the strong recommendations they made, they liked the Buzz program, but the limitations they identified was no service on Sunday and 30-minute intervals. And so again, I think as we look in terms of placemaking and change in demographics in downtown, that we need to look at that, because they rightly pointed out successful downtowns around the country are 7 days a week. And you need to be able to have places and programs like the Buzz to help serve residents and visitors to it. So I'm hoping that as we look in these discussions, we again plan for the increased density in people in downtown. And I think the Buzz is one of the areas that is going to be a critical element of that. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
And we will, Vice Mayor, we will definitely look into that. The Buzz is always an interesting tool that everybody wants, that we need to, it's easy to manipulate, a little easier to manipulate. So we're always open to different suggestions and working with the community to finding a more effective route for everybody. So our budget for this fiscal year is just over $13 million. With the opening of 3 miles of light rail, our light rail budget has gone up significantly. And then our fixed route and paratransit budget, the paratransit, like I said, does not include from the general fund the transfers from Dollar Ride. Something, so as I alluded to before, is the city's contribution to transit is $13.4 million. In addition to that, we get about $11 million in Proposition 400 money to help offset our budget. So we get $8 million, right now this year we'll get about, we're programming about $8 million for fixed route bus, which will fund about 8 of our 23 bus routes. And then another about $3.1 million in paratransit operations and to offset the increase in the regional trips, the potential increase. So we operate about 20 in total with Prop 400 in general fund, about $24 million in transit service in the city. And as I explained, so this fiscal year, we want to continue the Buzz connection to Riverview, and that creates a nice one-seat connection between downtown and the Riverview area. And then we're going to start construction on the Gilbert Road Light Rail extension, which should be completed in fall of 2018.
Thank you, Jody. Great job. Council, any questions for Jody? Thank you. Jeff McVeigh, I believe, is up. Jeff has the coolest job title in the organization. Jeff, remind everybody what the name of your job is.
Mayor, Council, morning. Jeff McVeigh, Manager of Downtown Transformation.
Thank you very much.
Mayor, Council, today I want to talk about some of the metrics that we're looking at as more of it. What I'm going to talk about is more of indicators of success in our placemaking efforts. So what we know and what your strategic initiative or strategic priority of placemaking highlights is that place matters. People have choices all over this country of where they want to live, where they want to operate their business. And if you don't have the place, then they are going to make another choice. So what I want to talk about is what we are going to look at, what we'd like to look at as we go through the future, of what those indicators of success are. Cindy and Jody and Mark have talked about those direct efforts in placemaking. What I'm going to talk about hopefully is what we should see as our metrics for if those efforts are successful. The first are those very obvious ones. The population of downtown, the number of housing units in downtown, and the number of households in downtown. what the graph shows on that I'm have displayed now is that population growth and household growth has been fairly flat since the year 2000. It's on a slight increase. There's been a couple of housing developments, specifically Encore, that have added population. But this indicates, or this highlights where our efforts are really focused right now in trying to encourage as much residential development in downtown as we can. We have current projects that are underway for Country Club in Maine. I've begun the outreach efforts, planning the outreach efforts for the offering of, or the RFP for the University of Mesa Drive. And we have several private developers that are very interested in downtown as a housing option. Another area where placemaking will be seen is the number of businesses, net gains and losses in businesses in downtown, as well as the important sales tax revenue that comes from those businesses. The scale of these graphs make it look like there's really huge differences between the number of losses and differences, but if you can see the numbers there, it's really pretty close. Actually, through light rail construction, there has been less business loss in downtown than was seen through the initial 20-mile construction through downtown Tempe, or downtown Phoenix and Tempe. We are actually at a point that right now where we are pretty close to having no net loss. So enough new businesses have entered into downtown in the recent months and past year where we are pretty close to, we have a very low vacancy rate. I can't say we're pretty close to zero, but it's a very low vacancy rate. And also, there has been a trend towards increasing sales tax revenue from those businesses. This is a very busy graph, but this is indicating what the full cash value and limited property value of all properties in the downtown area are. You'll see there's that spike around 2009, which reflects the two-year lag in property values as they relate to actuals. So in 2006, 2007, 2008, we had the Great Recession, and 2009 reflects that 2007 was the peak of property values, and it declined since then, but now we're starting to see again that upward trend. And hopefully in the next year or two, with when property values catch up to the light rail, that we'll see that trend increasing, especially as new development continues in downtown. And then my last slide is construction valuation. This is pulled directly from our permitting system, Tidemark. And this depicts in millions of dollars how much private investment has happened in downtown. You'll see the spikes that are showing in 2012 and 2014. Those are directly related to the Encore first phase development and Encore second phase development. Besides those, there has been limited amount of private investment in existing buildings. There's been a few new residential developments, single family houses in some of the neighborhoods south of Main Street, as well as some tenant improvements in businesses. 2016 looks like a pretty sad number right now, but that information was pulled very early in the year. And if we pulled it today, it would probably be better. And if we even pulled it at the end of the year, it would likely be much higher, as there are some fairly good developments that are just on the edge of being able to pull their permits, and that's when the data for their valuation would show up. I know that was the I thought I was going to be the last thing between you and adjournment, but for three of you, you're staying here. So I will close on that and let the mayor get out of here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions for Mr. McVeigh? Here's something out of the blue. Mr. Brady, I think Mr. McVeigh needs an assistant. As I look at what he's doing, and I just look at the intensity of activity in downtown and the number of projects that are coming that requires some city involvement, Jeff does a great job, but I think he's just got too much on his plate, and I think that's a good problem to have. I'm delighted to say that I think Jeff needs some help, but I guess we can continue that conversation offline.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much. Next item on our agenda is information pertaining to job order contracting projects. Councils, any questions about those items? The next item four, we're going to continue because some of those board minutes are still being worked on. Item five is to hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Council, any reports? Hearing none, Mr. Brady, tell us about scheduling of meetings and general information.
Sure, Mayor. Just a reminder, we do have the Public Safety Committee meeting following the study session. Our next study session in council meeting will be Monday, May 2nd. We are going to pick up some of the presentations that were deferred, so we will be starting early on May 2nd. And also this Saturday, April 30th, Vice Mayor Kavanaugh will be hosting us Pancakes and Surfing Family Fun Day from 9 a.m. to noon. So we invite everybody out to Rhodes Junior High Aquatic Center. And Mesa has challenged the City of Chandler's Police and Fire departments on a flow rider competition. So we'll see everybody then.
Thank you. Mr. Kavanaugh, can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I wanted to follow up on that. We've had a tradition the last number of years of having a new part of our District 3 Pancake Breakfast is the when Flow Rider opened. It's a great way to showcase one of the great amenities that we have in our community and at the same time support public safety. The last two evenings I've attended practices that were held for Chandler and Mesa personnel, and I think the competition will be spirited. Some of the rookie riders over the last 2 days expressed a lot of surprise over the force of the water and how it all works, but remember this is for a very good cause. We're asking people to help make voluntary contributions to support the 100 Club, which supports public safety personnel and their families in the time of challenge. The Chamber of Commerce and the community have come together on providing many, many items that we're going to be able to raffle off, and my thanks to all those who participated in that. And again, my thanks to all the colleagues sitting here at the table who helped make contributions towards the 100 Club for this project. With your help, we know it's already a success, and so we're hoping that that Mesa, in terms of city challenges, remains undefeated. Of course, next year we're talking about having the city managers and deputy and assistant city managers compete with folks from other communities. I'm just giving you a warning about that. So, anyway, I'll be an excited constituent. So, thank you, Mayor.
We could really sell some tickets today. Okay, thank you. I think that concludes the business on our agenda. I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Thank you.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. We are adjourned.